Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, January 18th, 2021. It is 2 days before Inauguration Day here in the States. And I'm the host of the show, Kara Santa Maria. And I want to just start out by thanking you once again for making Talk Nerdy possible. Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that's because of the generous support from advertisers and from individuals just like you. If you would like to pledge your support for the show, all you've got to do is visit Patreon, patreon.com/talknerdy. This week, I want to thank Leonard Prince, Robert Christ, Elise Christie, June Sapara, Christopher Pitts, Michael Gaucher, Mary Neva, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, Dudas Infinitas, David J.E. Smith, Daniel Lane, Charles Payet, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, and Brian Holden. Thank you all so much for your support. All right, let's talk about today's episode. This is a good one. So I had the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Kat Arney, virtually, of course. We didn't actually sit down in the same room. Actually, from across the pond. She's a leading British science writer, broadcaster, and public speaker. Her PhD is actually in developmental genetics from Cambridge, and she does an incredible and really important amount of work in public science communication. She's also got a great podcast called the Genetics Unzipped podcast, and she's got a new book out. It's called Rebel Cell: Cancer Evolution and the New Science of Life's Oldest Betrayal. This one is near and dear to my heart. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Kat Arney. Well, Kat, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me. This is lovely.
All the way from across the pond. And of course, we are recording on Wednesday, January 6th, for an episode that's going to go up, I think, in a week and a half. But we're recording in the midst of some stuff.
Some stuff
is going on here in the States. Some sedition, I would call it. And so we're following that closely. But against that background, we're going to try and remain present, as we just discussed, and we're going to focus on some other stuff that I think is really existential. It's really fundamental. It's very, important scientifically, but it's some stuff that really affects people's lives. And so I'm really excited to dive into your book, Rebel Cell: Cancer Evolution and the New Science of Life's Oldest Betrayal. How did you come up with that title? Or is that even the British title? Is that only the American title?
The British title is Rebel Cell: Cancer Evolution and the Science of Life, which I actually prefer. I will say I do prefer the US book jacket. I think the jacket is much nicer in the US version than the UK version. So your listeners will have to go and check that out and see which one they prefer. But Rebel Cell. So the original title, the working title for the book was actually Selfish Monsters, which as we'll get into a bit, you know, the theme of the book is all about the evolution of cancer, and cancer is this kind of evolutionary monster. And it's a play on the concept of hopeful monsters, which is this sort of evolutionary idea of these things kind of evolving and trying stuff out and all this kind of crazy stuff. But in the end, my publishers are like, it's a bit of a shit name. And I was like, and so we sat down and we brainstormed. We were like, Rebel Cell, because this is a cellular rebellion. And it really, the more I started to research and write the book, this idea that cancer is really when cells kind of rebel against the society of the body. And this idea that like our cells, our tissues are existing as a society, and our cells are behaving like good little cells should. They're not proliferating too much. They're not taking more than they need. They're dying when they should. They're cleaning up after themselves, all that kind of thing. And that cancer cells, they kind of cheat. They rebel against the rules that make tissues work. And these kind of rebellious cheating cells emerge as cancers. So the more I sort of started to get into this idea of tissues as a society and cancers as cheating cells, I'm like, yeah, that'll work. And then I think like Rebel Cell kind of sounds cool. I think
it does.
It stuck.
Pretty badass, actually. It's got like a badass title. I have to ask though, so you your training is in genetics. You're a developmental geneticist who also does a lot of like science writing, broadcasting, public speaking. You're not necessarily a cancer biologist. Not that those two things are far apart from one another. Has cancer always been a focus in your genetics research, or is this sort of a new area of interest for you?
Well, so my journey to where I am now, you know, I'm now a full-time professional, I guess, science communicator. I run mm-hmm. a communications consultancy. But my journey, I started as a scientist interested in genetics and development. I did a PhD in developmental biology and genetics. And then after that, I did a couple of failed postdocs, realized that the scientific lab life wasn't quite for me. And then I went to work at Cancer Research UK, which is the UK's, in fact, one of the world's biggest cancer research charities. And I was there for 12 years doing science comms. So that was an amazing grounding in cancer because unlike my life in the lab where, you know, if you're a researcher, you know that you're just kind of an inch wide and a mile deep. I had to be a mile wide and an inch deep. I had to know everything from the research that was going on, that the charity funds thousands of researchers across the UK, and everything from like the researchers who are looking at the molecules that run the cell cycle in yeast that make yeast cells divide, you know, this kind of engine of cell proliferation that underpins all dividing cells and cancer. So these really fundamental mechanisms of life, all the way through to developing drugs, to testing drugs, to clinical trials, to kind of psychological research and quality of life. So I spent 12 years there. I did a whole lot of communications. I was a media spokesperson. I helped to set up the charity's blog with a science writer that you guys may have heard of, a guy called Ed Yong, who's now like superstar science writer. He was my colleague for a number of years, and we set up the charity's blog and he's just, it was a fantastic time working with him. So that
Did
was
you
a
ever
real
go
ground.
To, Science Online, by the way?
Yes, I think so.
I wonder if we met there. I was a SciO regular.
Maybe, yeah. Like, probably that's going back to like old SciComm days. You know, when we used to call Twitter microblogging. That's like.
Yes.
That's back in the day.
That's where I met Ed originally, too. I feel like so many of my SciComm friends were really developed during that era. And it's been amazing to see, just as an aside, how
we
so many
of them We could play like 6 degrees of Ed Yong.
Yes.
we digress. My background really actually is the two sides of my life tied together in this book. So my first book, Herding Hemingway's Cats, was really understanding about, you know, how do our genes work? You start life as a single cell. And this was also what my PhD research was about, was like, you start life as a single cell, one set of genetic information, one genome. And that cell divides and divides and divides. And those cells specialize and genes get turned on and genes get turned off. And from this one cell, this one set of information, you unfold life and you unfold all the tissues in the body. And I was like, how does that work? And in my PhD, that was one of the questions I tried to start figuring out. Turns out it's really hard and I'm really bad at science, like in the lab, I'm very clumsy. So that was a bit of a non-starter. And then I went on to try and write the book to try and uncover that and talk to people who were a lot better at science to try and find that out. But where I did my PhD at a place called the Gurdon Institute in Cambridge. And that was a very, very special research institute because they combined cancer researchers with developmental biologists. So the top floor was developmental biologists. So people like me, you know, I was working on mouse embryos. They had fruit fly people, worm people, frog people. John Gurdon himself and his frog lab were there. And then on the other floor, they had all these cancer researchers. And we all used to hang out and talk. And you start to realize that developmental biology and cancer are two sides of life. So development unfolds life from one cell, like this cell with one genome, and you unfold life. And cancer unfolds from one cell and one mutated genome. You unfold a terrible disease. It's cells that are damaged and proliferating and changing and doing what they do. And it's like this idea of cancer is kind of a really aberrant version of life. It's like the dark side of life. And that's kind of the real idea that I wanted to get across in the book. We sometimes think about cancer as something that is other, it's alien, it's it's visited upon us. It's caused by something coming from the outside. It's like, it's our own cells gone rogue.
Yeah.
And there's lots of reasons why. You know, there are mutations and changes and the balance of power within the tissues of our bodies. But it starts from us and it goes deep, deep, deep in biology. And I think I hadn't quite realized till I started researching the book how many different organisms can get cancer. There's a great book I used, sort of a cancer evolution textbook, and it's got 20, 25 tiny typed pages of all the species that we know so far get cancer, you know, from aardwolves to bats to snakes to turtles to all sorts of things. And how old cancer is, you know, there's the week my book came out in the UK was a dinosaur fossil, 77 million year old dinosaur fossil with a tumor in it that was described. And there's like a 240 million year old turtle fossil with a tumor. And everywhere we look on this planet where we find human remains, we find evidence of cancer. So this goes deep.
And it makes sense in a way, because the more that you understand, or at least attempt to understand what the phenomenon that is cancer actually is, the more it's unsurprising that it's been with us since we have been, that it's been with the genome since the genome has been. And I think that probably it's important to take some time now, you and I, to dig deep into, I don't want to say debunking the myth, but clarifying exactly what cancer is as a process. Because like you said, I think one of the first things that, the first kind of misunderstandings about cancer is that we think of it through the filter of infectious disease. We're so used to sickness being something we catch, as opposed to having its kind of nucleation point within us. And so maybe we can take a little bit of time to develop that foundation so that we can dive deeper into some of these more complex topics. So maybe you can let us know, like, how do we define cancer? What is cancer as a disease?
Well, so this was kind of a big challenge, actually, because I sat down to write the book, and at Cancer Research UK, so many times I'd have to write explainers about cancer, and I'd sit down and I'd type out this little phrase, you know, cancer starts when a cell picks up mutations, changes in its DNA, and multiplies out of control. And I'd never really stopped to think, like, is that actually right? And as I started to really get into writing the book, you know, there's a lot of kind of realizations that came to me. So one was that cancer is not just human and it's not just modern, which is kind of a misconception. We think that cancer is this modern human disease. And it's like, nope, it's all across life. Where there is multicellular life, there is cancer. And that is because cancer is almost the inevitable consequence of being multicellular. If you're a multicellular organism and you have cells that are having to exist together and kind of have rules and do this and do that and behave, then you can get cheats. If one of those cells picks up changes in its DNA, in its instructions, then it can start to cheat. And cancer is kind of like almost like an emergent property out of tissues. And the other thing that's a bit interesting, you're like, okay, so cancer is caused when there's like mutations, right? So mutations cause cells to go wrong, and that causes cancer. And that's kind of a model we've been working with for about 100 years. You know, this is what we think of as like the somatic mutation theory of cancer. And it's a very fancy way of saying like the soma is the body. So somatic mutations means that you pick up mutations in the cells of your body, and that's what drives cancer. But no one has really, I think as scientists, we tend to only look at what's gone wrong. So we only look at cancerous tissues and say, okay, like what mutations are in here? Oh, we find all these mutations. That must be what caused the cancer, right? And no one looks at normal tissue, because until very recently, we didn't really have the tools to do it. You know, and I'm, you know, as well as I do, the huge advances in DNA sequencing technology. It's been mind blowing. And now we have the ability to look and to do it cheaply enough to start to look at tiny samples of cells from healthy tissue. And so researchers at the Sanger Institute in Cambridge a couple of years ago started doing this. And people were like, well, right, you're not going to really find anything because it's normal, healthy tissue. But, you know, you've got the budget, you do you. So they started looking at samples of tissue from eyelids that were removed from cosmetic surgery. They got samples of esophageal tissue. There's work going on looking at all the tissues of the body. These are healthy tissues, so not cancerous tissues. And they find that as we age, our bodies become a patchwork of mutation. So by middle age, I'm a woman like kind of crashing through my 40s. I am made of a lot of mutations already. And by the time you get to your 70s, you are carrying a lot of mutations in most of your cells. And these cells are starting to grow and grow out of control. And the really shocking thing, you know, we kind of knew that, yeah, you know, your cells have been around, they've seen some stuff, we'll pick up mutations, right? It makes sense, right? The extent of the mutations was absolutely staggering. And also the fact that a lot of those mutations, if they had found them in a cancer, you would say that that was a cancer gene, like a cancer gene fault, cancerous mutation. So this kind of idea that our bodies are just like patchworks of cells carrying all these cancerous mutations, that kind of throws out of the water the idea that, oh, well, a cell just picks up a mutation and then it becomes a cancer. And that was the idea that I had to really grapple with. It's like, what makes a bad cell? You know, what makes a sad cell? You know, your cells have seen some stuff. They're all sad. But what makes a sad cell become a bad cell? And that, right, I think, is the real fundamental, like, the challenge in what causes cancer.
And I mean, in your research, have you found that it's, you know, that it's really like a threshold effect? Like, when enough, you know, we often think, and maybe we should take a step back, but we think about this idea that these mutations accumulate over the lifespan. The older that we get, the more our cells get worn out, the more we have these coding errors or these random mutations, or sometimes the mutations happen because of external mutagens. Like, we're living in, you know, a toxic planet where we have pollution, where we have sources of radiation. But then on the flip side of that, some of us have predispositions. Like, our cells are already not so happy by the time we're born. And, you know, some of us carry certain types of mutations from our parents. Some of us have these spontaneous mutations that occur in utero. At what point do all of these things get to be, at what point do your cells say enough is enough, and then they just start replicating out of control? Exactly.
So there's a combination of things. So you definitely need mutations, but mutations are not enough.
Okay.
And in recent years, like, our understanding of cancer, I think, has become incredibly genetically reductionist. You know, we've just focused on the mutations, and a lot of the approaches to therapy are really focused on finding mutations and targeting mutations. So we've really just got this like mutational mindset that all it takes to make a cancer is mutations. But we know that that can't be the whole story, because there's some things that we're starting to understand now at the DNA level. So it's not just about picking up odd mutations here and there. What seems to be the difference between kind of sad cells that are, you know, maybe proliferating a bit, growing a bit of a patch somewhere, and the more those cells grow, the more likely they might be to pick up another mutation that allows them to grow even more. So this kind of stepwise, you know, you get a mutation, you expand more cells, they can pick up another mutation. That is not enough to make a cancer. What seems to be the real genetic issue is a kind of chromosomal catastrophe. So some massive rearrangement of the chromosomes, like much more doubling of the chromosomes, you know, some fault in cell division. So you get a doubling of the chromosomes. There's a process called chromothripsis, where the chromosomes kind of get smashed up and rearranged. So some kind of chromosomal chaos seems to be a trigger point. But again, it's not just enough for the genome. It's not just enough to have the mutations, the changes in the DNA, because this is an evolutionary process, right? And so if we imagine cells are like kind of organisms living in an environment, we know Charles Darwin teaches us that it's about the organism, but about the environment. You know, survival of the fittest isn't just about the biggest, the strongest, the smartest. It's about the organism that is most fit for its environment, right? So our cells are living in the environment of our bodies. And they are fit for that environment. We've evolved over thousands and thousands of years for our tissues to be kind of fit for the environment of the body. And mutations change the fitness of cells. Often they actually make cells less fit. Not all mutations are good. But if you pick up one that does make a cell more fitted to its environment, then it will be more likely to proliferate, to pass its genes on to the next generation. You get more cells. So this is okay. So you're like, right, we've got the environment of the body. We've got the cells. Cells can pick up mutations and changes, and then they can proliferate more and be more fit and successful. And then you're on the way to being a cancer. So the extra part of this, the kind of the next layer of this, is that the environment of our tissues does not stay the same throughout our lifetime. And the evidence for this is, it's fascinating, and it's also terrible. So the graph of risk of cancer with age is not a straight line. It's not a straight line from cradle to grave, which tells you that this isn't just about you picking up mutations in a stepwise way, because you should pick up mutations on a steady rate as you get older. It's your risk of cancer when you're younger is very, very low until really you get to about 60, and then it starts to go up quite a lot. So there is something in the environment of the younger tissue of the body that is suppressing these dodgy cells. Like, if cells have to be like super, super, super fit to have an advantage over younger tissue. But as we get older, we get, inflammation, our tissues get a bit loose and baggy, the matrix that holds our cells together starts to break down. We get less good at our immune systems get less good at patrolling the body and picking off rogue cells. So the environment changes. And then that's an environment in which these more kind of rebellious cells can start to thrive. So it's not just enough to have mutations, and it's also not just enough to have, damaged tissue. You need to have the combination of the two, and for those cells to have an advantage and to start to thrive and to go towards becoming a cancer.
So I think that one of the things that's probably important to clarify is the way that evolution by natural selection really does work. Like, I think it was important when you mentioned that fitness doesn't necessarily mean bigger, stronger, faster, because sometimes, smaller, weaker, slower is more adapted to the environment. It's really just, fitness is really just about how well you can, thrive, make viable offspring, or in this case, make new versions of yourself, make new cells. But one of the things that I think is sort of a misunderstanding, and maybe it's a function of the way our brains evolved to live within, our own environment, which is this earth, is that we tend to think of evolution as being a goal-directed process. We tend to think of it as moving towards some sort of improvement, when really evolution is just about, do you survive within this environment? And if the environment changes so drastically and you don't have the genetic capability to adapt, you will die, or your offspring will die. And I think sometimes when we think about cancer in this respect, understanding that there's no real goal, but instead it's just a runaway process, at least in my view, that helps me conceptualize this kind of complicated phenomenon. Cancer's not trying to do anything.
Exactly. I'm a metaphor junkie, and I do occasionally start to anthropomorphize a bit too much about the cells want to do this, the cells want to do that. Cells just want to survive. And it leads you down this road of evolution is directing somewhere. Cancers want to get worse and worse and worse. And it's like, no, they don't. There is no goal to evolution, but the cells that survive and can proliferate in the environment in which they find themselves in will then start to dominate the cells that are there. And it's the same. This is how evolution works across the planet, and it's this incredible process that gives us all the diversity of life on Earth is also the process that drives cancer. because you have these cells and they are being selected for. So the ones that survive are the ones that proliferate. It's not that they're particularly like wonderful or special. And, you know, you look around at evolution on Earth and there's like some pretty weird stuff out there. And you're like, what? How did you end up like that? It's like, well, that's what got selected for because this works in this environment under these circumstances. So cells really, it's like, you know, you kind of go, well, cells just want to live. But to a certain extent, like, yeah, if they die, they can't pass on their changes. Mm-hmm. And so all we see is the outcome of this evolutionary process of success and success and success and success and cells being selected because they are fitter in their environment. And the other thing that I think it's really important to touch on as well is that all cells in a cancer are not the same. In the same way that like all individuals in a population are not genetically the same. You know, all the humans on Earth are not genetically the same. All dogs are not genetically the same. All the mice living, you know, under the floorboards are not all genetically the same. And all the cells of a cancer are not the same because they are proliferating and picking up more changes and adapting, and some of them are dying and all this kind of stuff. So this is a population of mixed cells. And this is where things start to get really challenging, because when you try and treat cancer, you obviously want to get rid of all the cells because you want to get rid of the cancer. But if you don't get rid of all the cells, then the cells that survive your treatment can start to grow again. So this is why the absolute, like, the curative treatment for a cancer is surgery before it has spread through the body. That is curative. When you get to the point where you are having to use things like chemotherapy, even radiotherapy, there is a risk that there will be cells in that cancer that are resistant to the treatment. So you give someone a treatment, it looks like it's working, you know, because all the cells that are sensitive to this treatment are dying, but there will be some in there that are resistant. And after time, they grow back. And, you know, and this leads us to the many of us will know this kind of heart sinking moment where it's like, it looks like it's gone away and then it's come back and you can't use the same treatment again.
Yeah.
And you can go around several rounds of treatment. You get into second line, third line treatments, sometimes more than that. But you're really basically playing whack-a-mole at this point. And that is the challenge.
And you also sometimes see a phenomenon. I see this in the patients that I treat. And of course, I'm not an oncologist. I'm training to be a psychotherapist, but I'm working in what they call psycho-oncology, which I think should actually be called oncopsychology, but that's another conversation. And one of the things that I see with my patients oftentimes is that in longer survival rates, but still stage four or like a higher stage cancer, early on in the process, let's say the first 4 or 5 years, one or two treatments sustained them. And now maybe we're in the next 3 or 4 years and we've gone through 6 or 7 treatments already.
Yeah.
Because of that whack-a-mole situation. And because I'm interested to know if I don't want to call it the metaphor, but the way that we're the perspective that we're utilizing in viewing cancer as a Darwinian evolutionary process within the ecology of the body, do the stronger cells, the ones that tend to be resistant to treatment, then when they proliferate, I mean, do we see the same kind of thing that happens when, for example, antibiotic resistance develops, or what some are saying might have been the cause of the newly more infectious strain of COVID-19 that did this develop out of chronic COVID patients who were receiving antiviral treatments that allowed the weaker or the less mutated forms of the virus to die, but those that were more adapted and didn't fall victim to the treatment to proliferate, which, you know, ends up in a new strain.
Yeah, I mean, this is evolution in action, and we see it in cancer, and we see it. Antibiotic resistance is a great example. There's an anecdote in the book where we see resistance growing quite quickly to this new generation of cancer therapies that are very, very molecularly targeted. And when these therapies first came online, probably getting on for 10 years ago now, people were very excited about this idea that you could take a tumor, you could look at the DNA of the tumor, spot the mutations, and then give a patient a drug that targets those faulty genes.
Right.
And this was very exciting. And, you know, the first one of these was a drug for melanoma, for skin cancer. And, you know, this very eminent scientist went on the radio and he said, you know, this is cancer's penicillin moment. And you look back and you're like, yeah, it was. Because we know where we are now with massive problems with antibiotic resistance because of evolution. We use these drugs, the bacteria that are resistant to the drugs thrive and survive and keep going. And then you can't use that drug anymore. And we see exactly the same processes happening in cancer. So it's very hard writing this book because obviously cancer, and this is what I really want to get across to people, is not that cancer treatment doesn't work. Some cancer treatments do work really, really well. Yeah. You know, here in the UK, we know that half of all people diagnosed with cancer today survive for at least 10 years. And, you know, and that is improving all the time. And we have really exciting new drugs like immunotherapy and stuff like that. So, you know, this is not, I'm not saying, oh, all cancer treatment is rubbish and you shouldn't be treated for cancer. It's like, no, we are doing the absolute best we can. And half of all people will survive for at least 10 years after their diagnosis. What I'm saying is that particularly for advanced cancers, where there's lots and lots of diversity, lots of genetic diversity in there, we need to start thinking about different ways of approaching that treatment. Because this idea of giving a drug, waiting for resistance to happen, waiting for the cancer to come back, giving another drug, this is really not getting us very far. And when you really drill down into it, all these incredibly expensive, molecularly targeted drugs are not bringing the transformations in survival that we have been promised. When you really look at it, immunotherapy is a bit different. Some of the new immunotherapy drugs genuinely do seem to be curative for some people, not for everyone. But a lot of these very, very expensive targeted therapies are increasing survival by weeks, months. They're not curative. And you have to go like, why are we developing more and more and more and more and more of these drugs to just kind of eke out a little bit more survival? And I think it's time to be a bit smarter and really tackle this as an evolutionary problem, as an ecological problem. So that's the kind of stuff that I got really excited about.
So before we talk about what some of those, you know, new ways to look at treatment could be, I would love to go back to sort of, and again, I don't want to call it a metaphor because we're actually talking about evolution within the organism's ecosystem as a whole. But one of the places where, I guess in my mind, as I'm trying to make sense of it falls apart for me a little bit, is when we look at natural selection, specifically natural selection, not artificial selection. So not like breeding, for example. But when we look at natural selection within a closed system, let's say different organisms who all interact with one another on the side of a mountain or in an island or, you know, anywhere where you can define a biome or an ecosystem. Not only do we see the individual evolutionary processes that are tied to mutations and that are tied to increased or decreased fitness based on changes in the environment, but we almost see like a co-evolutionary phenomenon that occurs where there's a homeostasis within the food chain or within multiple organisms in adapting to the larger whole. We've seen that as human beings, we've really affected some negative change in that way because we, you know, are changing the climate at a pace that doesn't match with evolution. We're deforesting at a pace that doesn't match with evolution for many organisms. Some are evolving heavily because of that. So my question is, when we look at the body as a whole system, knowing that cancer is an evolutionary process, why does it get to a place, or how is it that it just runaways to the point where it actually kills the individual? Because we don't see that often in nature, where an organism evolves and becomes like an apex. It only really happens, it seems like, through human intervention. Like when we bring in an invasive creature that overtakes the natural predators, and then it grows out of control and kills everything in its path.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting the last thing that you landed on there was like the invasive species.
Right,
because,
right.
You know, that really is what cancer is. It's something that is, it starts from the tissues in the body, but the cancers that do really aggressively grow and spread, they have picked up so many changes that they are so out of whack mm-hmm. with the environment that they're in, and so overly competitive against the other cells that are around them. And again, it's not like they need to kind of
more.
Huh?
Those other cells, it's like they cannot keep them in check anymore.
Exactly. And, you know, obviously, like, cancer cells don't kind of like eat other cells, but they proliferate, they out-proliferate the cells around mm-hmm. them, and they spread. And the thing that kills most people with cancer is just the burden on the body. Cancer cells also, they do change the environment around them. They acidify, they toxify the tissue around them. You know, I've heard researchers talking about kind of the toxic swamp inside right. a tumor. So, you know, they consume lots of nutrients. They outcompete other cells for nutrients. They start to migrate around the body. They turn up in new organs and then start to proliferate there and change the environment there.
So they steal our blood supply. Like many tumors steal vessels, or they'll grow new vessels to divert blood to them.
Exactly. Yeah. So they kind of recapitulate all these processes that are normal in the body, but just like kind of turned up to 11. There's all sorts of stuff going on. You see all the kinds of crazy processes of life happening in cancer. So, for example, this like cancer cells can kind of switch to become like blood vessels. So instead of sending out signals to get blood vessels to grow towards them, which what some cancers do, there's this phenomenon where cancer cells actually turn into blood vessel cells, which is just absolutely wild. We know that cancer cells can actually, this is the most mind-blowing thing, cancer cells can have sex. You have to read the book to find out exactly how. It's not a good definition of good sex, but like they will fuse together and start popping out little cancer cells that are resistant to treatment. And you're like, whoa. Like, when I learned that, I was at a conference and it's just like, really? Because while I was researching the book, there was kind of like whispers of it. Like, people were like, you know that there's this like cell sex thing. I was like, what? I'm like, yeah. And people would never talk to me about it properly. I was like, tell me. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, maybe some guy there. I heard there's a guy in Arizona doing some weird experiments or whatever. And then, I went to this conference. And this guy in Baltimore called Kenneth Pienta. And I described the experiment quite a lot in the book. He's got these cells. He's got this, it's almost like the Hunger Games for cells. He's got this little kind of silicon chips where he puts cells in them like an arena. And under those conditions, he's seen cells fusing together and spitting out these little kind of resistant cancer cells. And then when you start to look back through the literature, like nothing is new. And there's been these examples. People have looked in tumors and found these weird fused cells. And everyone's been like, yeah, it's not like, it's just weird, isn't it? They're not going to do anything. And you're like, oh, yeah, they probably do. And every innovation of life happens in cancer. It's just like evolution in kind of a microcosm. And these cells are supercharged, and eventually in the cancers that do proceed unchecked in the body, they win.
I think there's kind of like a crisis that occurs sometimes in our consciousness when we start to try to change the paradigm that we utilize to think about something so fundamental. And so, you know, you mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation about the sort of paradigm that we had always used within the biomedical community about how we see cancer, and moving over to a much more evolutionarily oriented perspective of cancer brings with it, I think, some kind of existential angst. How do we sit with, or maybe how did you sit with even personally as you were doing the research and developing this story, with the realization that, you know, we often like to use value judgments and say, well, cancer is bad. Cancer is good cells gone bad, or cancer is correct biology gone wrong. But really, this is what is. cancer is natural in its own strange way.
It is. It's the inevitable consequence of multicellularity. And it certainly made me think differently about my own body, about my cancer risk, about, you know, people that I know and all kinds of things. And cancer is a terrifying disease. It's someone very close to me is going through cancer treatment right now. And it's like, it's really scary. It's very, very dark and scary. But it's that sort of feeling that like, this is life. And I've spoken to a lot of people since writing the book, and a few people who have had experiences of cancer, and they say, you know, actually, it made me feel a lot less to blame for my cancer, because there's a lot of blame that we put on it. Like, oh, what caused it? What did you do? Did you smoke? Did you do something wrong?
Yeah. So much stigma.
You know, this idea that like it's something impure, and that's gone back, you know, centuries and centuries, that cancer was some, like, you know, if you did something wrong and offended the gods.
Right.
And today, you know, this in the wellness culture that we have, like, oh, it must be something toxic or some stress or something bad you've done. And in many cases, like, this is an emergent thing. It's like, it's such a combination of so many things. And, you know, try not to increase your mutational load. I would say, you know, one of the best ways we know of increasing your mutational load is to smoke. So probably don't do that. It's not a great idea. But all the other things, you know, people are like, oh, was it this? Was it that? What was it? Like, in many cases, we don't know. And if you lived, for want of a better word, a perfect, perfect, pure, blameless, healthy existence, there is still a chance that you would get cancer because your cells just go wrong. Because that's what cells do. You are made of trillions and trillions of cells that divide millions and millions of times in your lifetime. And actually, the incredible thing, and it made me sort of respect my body a lot more and want to look after it a lot more, is that we don't get more cancer. And this seems really counterintuitive, because cancer is very common on a population level. You know, one in two people will get cancer at some point in their lifetime. And then you go, like, actually, on a personal level, cancer is incredibly rare. And you're like, what do you mean? It's common and it's rare. It's like, you are made of trillions of cells that divide millions and millions of times in your lifetime. And each one of us will probably get one, maybe two, if we're unlucky, individual new actual aggressive cancers in our lifetime. And that's like a one in 10 with 14 zeros after it. It's like the odds on the world's shittiest lottery.
Yeah, like, I have some of those patients who have had two, maybe even three primary cancers. And it's like the shit lottery.
Yeah.
When somebody gets their third primary cancer, you know, where it wasn't a metastasis, it was a brand new cancer development. It's so rare.
Yeah. And you have to go, in some of those people, you're like, there probably is some kind of underlying hereditary predisposition, because, you know, you're just kind of adding one more layer of mutations to everything to start with. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's the thing. It's like, you look at your tissue and, you know, like I said, I'm sort of, you know, getting to a ripe middle age, I'll say nearly, you know, and I've got freckles and my skin's all sort of like, you know, starting to just not be as buff as I was, maybe, you know, when I was younger, and you know, everything's like starting to go a bit. But you're like, my body is amazing because my cells are just full of mutations and doing their own thing, and they're, you know, fighting it out between them. And I am healthy, more or less. You know, I've got my own things wrong with me. But like, your body is amazing. And the fact that we do broadly control the health of our tissues, and that then genuinely it starts to make you think, well, what is cancer prevention? Cancer prevention is about maintaining tissue health. Obviously don't try and pile in the mutations, but you're going to get mutations. You cannot prevent every single mutation. You just can't, because the processes of life making energy in your cells, like every time you duplicate your DNA, you pick up mutations. That's just life. But how do we really understand what is healthy tissue? How do we suppress these rogue cells? How do we encourage the immune system to seek out and find and destroy them? Because actually, if we could really push the onset of cancer further from, you know, when that curve starts to go up from your 60s, if we start to push that out to like your 70s, your 80s, that will make a really, really big difference. because you know, we've all, the kind of fundamental thing is we've all got to die of something, which
absolutely
is depressing. And but like, I'd rather people didn't die of cancer in their 60s or their 70s or their 50s or their 40s. You know, yeah, or at that it was at the end of a very long life.
Right. At least not an aggressive, short acting, you know, because some people do have just chronic cancer. And we've really gotten to a place with certain types of cancers, some of them, like you mentioned, with molecular markers or with hormone markers, where people, almost like with HIV, it's like the cancer's there, but it's managed. And their life is extended. And so if you're just starting that journey at the, you know, ripe old age of 85, you know, that's a very different story than if you're starting that journey at the age of 35. And that reminds me of the question, one of the questions that came up for me really early on when you talked about paleontological and anthropological evidence of cancer, whether it be in human beings or other animals, and this sort of misperception that cancer is new. I wonder how much of that is because A, we didn't know what it was prior to a certain point in our, you know, scientific history, but B, we just didn't live that long a long time ago.
Yeah.
So we died before most people got it.
Yeah, it's, you know, a little of column A, a little of column B. But yeah, no, that's absolutely the case. You know, human life, we are living now longer than humans have ever lived on this planet. And with that, alas, comes the increased risk of the diseases of aging, one of which is cancer. The others are things like neurological conditions, like dementia and things like that, which, you know, we're living longer. Yay! We're going down to all these diseases.
The question is there like an inevitability? Like, is there a certain point where, you know, it's going to happen?
Yeah, I've always wondered about this. So I did have to think. I went to speak to a guy called Peter Campbell at the Sanger Institute, who's one of these leading cancer geneticists. And I was like, well, what's the end game with trying to understand and treat cancer? And he's like, I don't know. I guess you live long enough to die of something else.
Right. Yeah.
Which is not great as a charity fundraising slogan. You know, I can't see Cancer Research UK adopting that. You know, together we will enable you to live longer, long enough to die of something else. But, you know, that's, you kind of run up against these big issues of mortality. And, you know, I've talked to a few people who are the transhumanists and longevity people. And you're like, well, if you live long enough, because this is an emergent disease of multicellularity, you will probably get cancer. What's very interesting is that the people who seem to make it over 100 don't. So this, I think, like the super centenarians are super interesting because there's something in their tissues, clearly, that is very suppressive of cancer. And I think we should be really looking at that. That's very interesting.
It is. It's
I want what they've got.
You know, it's interesting, this kind of, again, more sort of existential question that I'm probably on the other side of the people that you talk to, like the transhumanists who like just want to extend life at all costs and are really interested in like curing aging. I'm much more of an existentialist thinker in that I think that death is what gives life meaning. If we didn't have that, you know, mortality salience, it would be much harder for us to live our lives to the fullest. And I work with people with cancer, and my patients really run the gamut from newly diagnosed and dealing with the anxieties around that to chronic to dying. You know, I help people die oftentimes, and I work with them in those final stages of growth in their life. And one of the things that I think is really fascinating about cancer, and maybe I hate to put it this way, but one of the gifts that cancer can give us is that it's a way to die that gives us oftentimes an understanding of time, and it gives us the gift of awareness as we're dying, unlike sudden death. I think a lot of people who are really afraid to die, when you ask them, how do you want to go? They'll say, I want to get in a, you know, some sort of horrible accident so that I'm dead before I know it. Like they just, the process of dying is terrifying to many people. But in so many of my patients that I've worked with who have cancer, who have an awareness that their life is shortened because of it, there's also this lust for life and this ability to really just crystal clear focus on what matters. That's like a very beautiful gift that such a terrible disease has sort of bestowed upon them.
I mean, I think it's absolutely heartbreaking. I don't quite know what the situation's like over in the US, but you know, here in the UK with the pandemic, we've seen people missing cancer diagnoses, missing cancer treatment. And, you know, we've pretty much been under rolling lockdowns for the best part of a year. The impact on people who know that maybe this year is the only year they have left, and you can't do the bucket list thing, you can't even go and see your family. I think this is incredibly, incredibly hard. Situations like this make us really realize what we should value in life. And when it comes to cancer, where you sort of feel that you've got this timer ticking, definitely, I think is incredibly hard, and particularly under these circumstances.
We've definitely been grappling with that. You know, I have a few patients that are dying and know that they're dying, and it's such a strange and like you said, just hard. It's just a shitty experience living through COVID and knowing I can't go on that trip and I can't do the things that almost always historically would have been interventions, right? Like, do the things you've wanted to do. And so it's something that I've been grappling with. It's something that I've been writing about and might even publish about, is like dying amongst a backdrop of limitation. But the truth is, that's also the case for many people without the kind of chaos of COVID. For people who have life-limiting illnesses like ALS, or for people who have life-limiting illnesses, even like cancer, when sometimes a tumor will aggressively start to grow out of the blue and it will be debilitating. Or a tumor will grow in the brain that changes one's ability to exist the way that they did previously. So even without COVID, I think that these questions about how do I process and how do I experience my final days, weeks, months, even years, knowing that I have the limitations that I didn't have when I was a teenager. It's a hard thing, and it's a different thing for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's kind of at the end of the book, is like that real like grappling with mortality and what does it mean to successfully treat cancer? What does it mean for us to learn to live with cancer? And you know, we sort of haven't talked about some of the more evolutionary adaptive ways of treating cancer, but the idea that you could cancer could become, in many more cases, this chronic disease that you're steering its evolutionary trajectory using even just the drugs that we have in much cleverer ways, balancing the populations of cells, monitoring much more effectively, and making cancer a chronic illness. And one of the trials I talk about is led by a guy called Bob Gattenby down in Florida. It's incredibly interesting stuff. And the first clinical trial he did was in prostate cancer. And the idea is, briefly, you sort of give people cycles of this chemotherapy drug called abiraterone, and it's based on whether their tumor is growing or shrinking. When they start the trial, you give them the drug, you monitor the size of their tumor until it has shrunk by half. Okay. And at that point, you're assuming that this drug has killed off most of the cells that are sensitive to the drug. But there will be resistant cells in there. These are men with advanced prostate cancer. And then you stop treating and you wait for the cancer to grow back to where it was. And the principle there is that the cells that are growing back are sensitive cells, but they keep the resistant cells in check, because actually there's a cost to being resistant. The resistant cells are actually less fit. They're only more fit when all the sensitive cells have gone, right? It's like a three-legged horse can win a race if all the four-legged horses have died, right?
Yeah,
it's that principle. So you're balancing these populations of cells, but you're taking people who are being treated with a drug that is working, and then you're saying, great, it's working, now we're going to stop. And you wait for the cancer to grow back. And one person who took part in the trial said that they didn't want to. No, it was like, this is working. I don't want to stop. We're going to keep going with the drug until my tumor's shrunk. And inevitably, their cancer came back pretty quickly. Yeah. The other and people on the trial, the cancer comes back and then you treat again and you kind of ride this roller coaster. And for however long it takes for the cancer to grow back and to shrink and to grow back and to shrink. And, you know, they have people who are on very short cycles and people who are very long cycles. They have had men, the typical survival time for this cancer is about 18 months from when it's they start the treatment to when it's really just progressed and there's no point continuing with the treatment. So time to progression, 18 months. They have men who've been on this for over 4 years, and overall they've taken less drug than they would have done had they been treated conventionally. Their quality of life is much better because they're on long periods without being treated. And once they've got their head round the fact that this is more like a kind of a rheostat, sort of a thermostat, you're dialing it up and down, then we're going to get rid of everything, nuke it from orbit. And they're living with this disease. I genuinely think that this kind of approach is, for some people, particularly for advanced cancers, is the way forward for improving longer survival. And there's more trials underway, and there's calls out for more grants and more funding in this area. So I think it's really exciting. But yeah, that you can imagine the first people on that trial lying in bed at night going, right, okay, you know, hope this works. And the researchers themselves were like, really, really hope this works, because but it does, and it's just incredible. And even more other approaches, just using the drugs we have in different ways, employing evolutionary strategies, using drugs that are even less targeted, but in different combinations, kind of, you know, 1-2 punches in the right time and the right place.
I was interested in that idea too. This idea of like a multivalent approach, because we see that sometimes with genetically modified organisms. So if we're developing a crop and that crop has a resistance gene, and then ultimately the weeds around it start to develop, or that crop itself starts to develop resistance to that, that if we use, the weeds around it, or let's say the pests around it start to develop resistance to its resistance, that some of the ideas of how to kind of stay in this evolutionary arms race and stay one step ahead is, let's not just use a single resistance, or like treat a single resistance, let's say like with MRSA, for example, switching from GMOs over to antibiotic resistance bacteria. But if we treat it with a multivalent or a multi-strain antibiotic, then it's less likely that there's going to be 3 different resistances that are developed. It's much more likely that it'll only develop 1 or 2.
Yes.
That sort of an approach that some researchers are using?
Yeah, so there's definitely a lot of interest in using combinations of drugs, like combination therapy. And this goes all the way back to the very early years of chemotherapy. It's Sidney Farber working in Boston, working with children with leukemia. And the right combination, he sort of just brute force by luck and a bit of judgment, worked out the right combination, the right order, the right timings of these drugs with different sorts of action that would ultimately treated the cancer and is now responsible for curing many, many, many children with leukemia when it was a fatal disease. Right. So, you know, it's this kind of approach. There are combination therapies that we use in cancer. I think we probably don't use them as rationally and as intelligently as we can. And now we have things like ability to look at how the genetic populations of tumors, we can do a lot more really clever computer modeling and all this kind of stuff. The idea that you could like try and game out, you know, in silico, you know, game out different strategies, I think is really exciting. But yeah, the example of this is basically, rather than going, so with some cancers, you do want to make it a chronic condition where we're just treating with good quality of life for as long as possible. But then you go, okay, an evolutionary strategy to drive cancer to extinction.
Right.
And that really is like the combination idea of the right threats at the right times will extinguish this population.
It's almost the same as surgery early on. It's just removing all of it. If you can 1, 2, 3, maybe even 4 punch it in a way that none of those really strong cells persist, that you're using enough hardcore drug that you actually are killing every single last cancer cell, then
exactly.
It's gone.
Exactly. And, you know, that's why we combine things like surgery with radiotherapy and surgery with chemotherapy and chemotherapy with radiotherapy. But yeah, I think there's a lot more capacity to do that. And particularly for advanced cancers where we really haven't made a lot of progress, or the cancers that have come back again, you know, we still need to make a lot more progress in these areas. But this idea of really thinking about devising extinction strategies And these are strategies. These are just not just another new targeted drug, right? It's how do we use the drugs that we've got in a better way to drive a population of cells to extinction? And Bob uses the example of the heath hen, which is quite a nice example. So this was it's a turkey-sized bird that was found all up the eastern seaboard of the US. And okay. When the colonists arrived in the US, they basically hunted it a lot because it tasted good, a bit like turkey. Yep. There's this sort of myth that maybe the first Thanksgiving turkey was actually a heath hen. And so there was a big attack kind of hunting. It ended up on a very small area of Martha's Vineyard. And then the habitat changed. So that's a different type of threat. So people started building in the area. There were a couple of really harsh winters, different threat. And then there was just a disease that wiped everything out. And the last heath hen died, I think, in 1932. He was so rare that he had a name. It's called Booming Ben. But it's this idea of like the right time, the right attack, the right kind of strategy that the population just cannot recover from it. And it's interesting now with the new generation of immunotherapy drugs. These are drugs that stimulate the immune system to recognize and destroy cancer cells. I think using those in combination with other treatments, I think is potentially really exciting as well, because the immune system is an incredible beast. And if we can wake that beast to target the challenge of cancer, I think is powerful. But the drugs we have at the moment, they work for some people, they don't work for everyone. And in some rare cases, they can actually really massively accelerate cancers. So you want to be really careful when you're tickling the immune system, for sure.
And I think the other nuanced kind of side of this that we, so I've sort of worn both hats. I worked as a neuroscientist for several years, like in a wet lab setting, working with mice and then birds. And then I've also worked in neuropsychology and now just straight more therapeutic clinical psychology. And one of the things that I have learned in doing work in sort of existential and humanistic approaches to clinical psychology is how devoid of that humanistic mentality a lot of bench work can be. And so I bring this up because that other dimension to cancer treatment that we almost don't want to think about, but is so fundamentally important when it comes to the clinical side of it, is that oftentimes the cure is more detrimental to the body than the disease, at least in terms of sustainability. And it's not uncommon for me to see in my patients that point in time where sure, there might be another treatment available and sure, there might be another angle of approach, but they're so tired and they're so sick that they make the very difficult, very personal decision to say, I can't do another round of a new chemo, or I just can't do a new type of radiation again. I'm done. And that's the part that is sometimes missing from the equation, but that's so important for us to remember, is that we also have to be able to tolerate these treatments.
Mm, absolutely. And I think, this kind of this narrative of the cure has been really misleading, because it's made us feel like that if we could only just get to it, we could get the cure. And from one side of it, it's this misleading idea that the cure for cancer will be one thing, one treatment for all cancers.
Right.
When, of course, it will not be.
Cancer was one disease, yeah.
Exactly. When of course, it will not be. But also, it gets to this idea that, if only you could just hit it hard enough, we could cure it. And the cure should not be worse than the disease itself. And certainly, the quality of life is absolutely, absolutely important. And we're very bad as society about talking about dying, about death, even about palliative care. Incredible underfunding and underappreciation of palliative care and the benefit that it can bring. I saw a really interesting study where people who received proper palliative care at the end of life for lung cancer actually survived longer.
Yeah.
And this isn't like treatment that's aimed at extending their life. It's just purely
aimed at reducing
quality.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, on that cheerful note, really.
It really is. I think it really is cheerful. To me, it imbues me with hope that there is still this fundamental qualia that is somewhat distinct from the randomized controlled trials, that there is a human side of cancer that is difficult to measure, that is hard to put our finger on, but that is so fundamental in the research and development, but also the clinical side of cancer treatment. These are people living with this disease, and they're brilliant and resilient and beautiful and inspiring people that find their own way through that course. But I love that you've done such an amazing job to dig deep into the literature, to interview brilliant scientists who are at the front lines of developing new treatments, and to give us a completely new, I mean, this really is kind of a Kuhnian paradigmatic shift in how we see cancer, which hopefully will open up in a whole new cohort of kind of young and less, let's say, tired and boxed in cancer researchers to approach the problem of cancer in a whole new way.
I hope so. I'm incredibly excited. You know, as someone who's been around the block in the cancer research world, I'm incredibly excited by the potential for these new evolutionary ideas that sort of viewing cancer as a disease of species and ecology within the body. But also, like you say, I really want to reclaim the word holistic, because it's being kind of taken by like the woo-woo alternative medicine side of things. Yeah. But this idea that this is a disease of the body, it's a disease of the tissues, it's something that we need to think of as a whole system problem, not just targeting the mutations in a small part of a tumor, because that's really not going to get us much further. This is a disease, a biological process that comes from us. It lives within us, and we need to really understand it and tackle it as such, I think, if we're going to make more progress in the future.
Hear, hear. Well, Kat, you know, usually at the end of my interviews, I ask my guest the same two questions. And I have to say, I mean, I always say this, but I also always mean it. I'm fascinated to hear how you conceptualize and respond to these two questions, given the work that you do, both having been a lab scientist and now working as a public kind of communicator of science to increase science literacy. And given that you've done these deep dives, which I think have brought up a lot of very deep questions about mortality and about meaning. So they're kind of big picture questions. Are you ready for them?
Okay.
All right. Against, again, a backdrop of chaos.
Well, it's 10 o'clock at night here and I don't have a drink. So let's see how we go.
Shit. I'm like, do I give you time to pour? No, we can do this.
We can do this.
Okay. So when you think about the future, in whatever context feels relevant to you right now in this moment, so it can be personal, it can be cosmic, or anywhere in between. The first question, which is kind of the rougher one, is what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night, that concerns you the most, that you're, you know, maybe pessimistic, maybe even cynical about, just something that really deeply worries you? And then on the flip side of that, to kind of lighten the air, what is the thing that you are genuinely, authentically, and just really fundamentally hopeful and optimistic about?
So, the thing that keeps me awake at night at the moment is worrying about the person who's very close to me who's going through cancer treatment, and also I'm worrying about sort of some other issues in my own health that are going on, and the general like, oh, we're in the middle of a global pandemic and like nothing can just be easy and normal. Like, trying to access medical care for things that are not COVID right now is really challenging. And so it's sort of adding this extra layer of stress onto a stressful situation. And I think that it's what keeps me awake, I guess, really is just how this pandemic has exposed the cracks in what we thought was like, you know, reasonably good kind of life here. You know, it's exposed problems with childcare. Something keeping me up at night is like the people that work for me, a lot of them have children, and things have got very difficult again here now in the UK lockdown because the schools have closed. So it's all these ways that the pandemic has just taken what we thought was, you know, well, there's life and there's problems and there's rare and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, oh yeah, well, what happens if we just shut all the schools and we shut all the hospitals and you can't get your regular treatments? And what a time to be alive. So that's the stuff that keeps me awake at night. the stuff that I'm genuinely excited about is I am genuinely excited about the innovations and the technology that we have in the life sciences, which is the area that I work in, and the ways that people are innovating, are tackling problems, you know, like the way that the COVID vaccines have happened in a year, I think has just been incredible. I work for my company. We work with like really innovative organizations and companies in the life sciences. And just seeing people's ideas, what is possible, I think just makes me really excited about the future. Even, you know, for some of the diseases that I've been working on in for various organizations, you know, in the past 5 years, there's been treatments where there were no treatments before for long-term conditions that were life-limiting. So that really gives me a lot of hope.
Well, Kat, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you today, to learn from you, to reflect with you. I got so much out of this interview, and I know that so many of my listeners did as well. Everybody, the book is Rebel Cell, Cancer, Evolution, and the New Science of Life's Oldest Betrayal. Kat, thank you so much for joining us on the show this week.
Thank you. This has been a joy.
And to everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.